Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is New Books in National Security, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Beth Windisch. I'm joined by Joanna Cook, author of the book A Woman's Place, U.S. Counterterrorism Since 9/11. Joanna Cook is a senior research fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization at King's College London, adjunct lecturer at Johns Hopkins University, a senior research affiliate with the Canadian Network for Research on Terrorism, Security, and Society, and a non-resident fellow at the Program on Extremism at the George Washington University. She holds a PhD in war studies and a master's in conflict, security, and development, both from King's College London, as well as a bachelor's in political science from the University of Regina. Her research interests focus broadly on terrorism and counterterrorism. She regularly presents her research to leading policymakers and practitioners around the world and is a frequent commentator in international media. Joanna, welcome to the show.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me here today.
Can you tell us more about your background and how you became interested in this topic?
Yeah, of course. From a very early age, I had a real interest in the stories of young women who had survived conflict or who had been surrounded by it. So whether it was Anne Frank's diary, I've Lived a Thousand Years, stories about young women in the wars in Yugoslavia, for example, there was always an interest about women who had been subjected to these kind of conflicts. And as I grew up, I wanted to be a war correspondent, took me to places around the world that really started to kind of open my eyes a little bit more to what contemporary conflict issues looked like. So I had a chance to go down to places like Rwanda. I was based out of Turkey and traveling through the Middle East a little bit. And the one thing that really struck me as I continued to kind of look more and more at conflicts and read these stories is that, you know, women were often viewed as victims or portrayed as victims in international discourses, in the news, in the media. But a lot of the women I saw were the ones that were rebuilding their communities after a conflict. They were ones that were in some cases, you know, perpetrators of violence. They were ones that were actually working in the police forces to try and secure their societies. And this was a real story that was not being told or an angle that really wasn't getting the kind of attention I thought I deserved or I thought it deserved. And that's really what's kind of drawn me to this field. I started my PhD in 2013 and was looking at women in counterterrorism at this time. And this is exactly the period aligned almost perfectly with the rise of ISIS. And so alongside this focus on women in counterterrorism, it also gave me an opportunity to really see the roles of women evolve in this jihadist group in a way that we just hadn't seen before. So that's kind of brought me up to where we are today and the real kind of focus of the book.
Using the policies and practices of the Department of Defense, USAID, and Department of State in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, you examine the role of women and gender in U.S. counterterrorism efforts following the attacks of 9/11. How did you choose to scope the book to these agencies and countries?
Yeah, as you all know, there's dozens of agencies, departments that focus on some aspect of counterterrorism around the U.S. government. But the reason I've landed on these three is if you look at the national security strategies, if you look at national strategies for combating terrorism, if you look at interagency efforts to combat terrorism internationally, it's these three the Department of Defense, Department of State, and USAID that most consistently were working together on programming that related to women. And this is something that really became visible as well in the National Action Plan on Women, Peace, and Security. You know, what these three departments and the U.S. Agency for International Development represent are all of the actors present in that full spectrum approach. So really looking at everything from the kind of preventative CVE efforts that you'd see coming out of USAID all the way through to kind of diplomatic policing and direct kinetic military actions on the ground. So these three agencies often work together in efforts in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen. And I think are really the key agencies that really lead U.S. International efforts in this space. And the reason I chose Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and Yemen, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan are two very clear examples of the U.S. at war and looking at what 9/11 meant for these two conflicts in relation to women. But I think Yemen is a really unique and often under-examined case study because, you know, Yemen has been considered, you know, at times it's ebbed and flowed in terms of its threat or perceived threat level. You know, whether it was Anwar al-Awlaki drawing or inspiring kind of Western recruits, whether it was Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula attempting to perpetrate attacks against the U.S. abroad. You know, Yemen's often been a very active yet overlooked example where there was so much activity also going on in terms of U.S. counterterrorism efforts in a non-conflict space. The U.S. was never at war in Yemen. And it really represented another kind of interesting example of how counterterrorism could be examined. Syria obviously came up a little bit later on, particularly with the rise of ISIS. But it's one of the ones that I examined a little bit less in the book. It's primarily Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen.
You put forward a multi-layered framework for examining women's roles in counterterrorism, looking at the different ways women were involved, how they were involved, and the narratives or justifications surrounding their involvement. How did you go about developing this framework?
Yeah, you know, this framework was something that I've really tried to kind of shape as a tool for practitioners, for policymakers, to be a little bit more reflective or to think about how, where, and why women have become visible in counterterrorism practices. And so for the book, it's developed particularly in response to the case of the U.S., but it's developed in a way that's generalizable enough that you can look at a country like Pakistan or South Africa or, you know, Nigeria or Brazil and use the same kind of framework to really think about how, where, and why women might become visible in those discourses and practices. But what that framework really did, and I'll give you a little bit of background on how I actually came up with the framework. So for the book, I reviewed approximately 500 U.S. Documents, speeches, articles, everything that had been published by whether it was the Bush, Trump, or Obama administration, the Department of Defense, Department of State, or USAID, or any of the key kind of documents or strategies that outline some kind of aspect of this overarching approach to counterterrorism. So by reviewing all of these documents, I was looking for two things in particular, the discourses and the practices related to women in counterterrorism. And I supported this with about 40 primary source interviews with leading practitioners and figures that had significant roles over this period as well. And as I was going through these interviews, as I was going through all these documents, what really jumped out at me was that, you know, women were often referenced in very clear categories. And so, for example, women were referenced in terms of their relationship in a terrorist group as terrorist actors. They were talked about as security actors or practitioners. They were talked about in terms of rights and equality. There was about seven different categories that women were generally discussed in. And so this was the kind of first step where, you know, you get a chance to see how women are discussed in relation to counterterrorism. The second layer of that was looking at the factors that impacted how women evolved within the Department of Defense, Department of State, and USAID in these counterterrorism-related practices. And so this was a little bit more how those categories of women evolved. So we look at women as security practitioners, for example, women who were soldiers in the Department of Defense or diplomats in Department of State or aid workers in USAID. And we look at how their roles on the ground evolved and why that was. So it looked at things like the operational environment they were in that were evolving significantly over this period. You know, what initially the situation was in places like Afghanistan and Iraq evolved significantly over this period of time. And this meant that the roles that they played in relation to countering terrorism evolved significantly with that as well. We also saw things like women-centric efforts of terrorist groups evolve over this period. So, for example, Al-Qaeda in Iraq initially had restricted female suicide bombers, but then increasingly started utilizing them. And what that factor meant was that all of a sudden you had female suicide bombers coming up in greater numbers, but not a capability to search women adequately at things like checkpoints. And so that prompted a response for practitioners to set up new units of women that could actually search and engage with local women who might be posing a risk. And so it looks at those factors that look at how women evolved at the agency level. Or there's kind of three general categories. So discursive factors are like the kind of language that was evolving in this period at the international level and the U.S. Level, but also operational factors. So looking at things like the operational environments and the operational objectives of the day, the women-centric efforts of terrorist groups. But I think the third aspect of this was looking at institutional factors. And this is something that in this space, I don't think we do enough of. We don't actually look closely enough at those institutions that themselves are developing and implementing counterterrorism practices. And this is what a really, really interesting angle. And I've got three chapters in the book, one that looks at each of the main departments I highlighted. But looking at things like how each had a history of women and gender within their own programming, the kind of institutional limitations they faced, things like bureaucratic limitations, funding challenges that actually directly impacted programming to do with women in some cases, but also looking at things like interagency cooperation and collaboration. And so those were the kind of factors that were really impacting how women evolved at that agency level. And then the last kind of component of this framework were the justifications that were often stated to include women. And I'll just really, really briefly touch on these. But I think this is something you continue to hear today. You often hear one of these three justifications stated when women's inclusion is being promoted. The first is operation and innovation. So really trying to highlight how there's an operational benefit or an innovation in practice by women's inclusion. But there's also the second kind of justification that's often stated is discussing women's rights. And so it's like it's their democratic right to participate, or their rights are most impacted by terrorist violence, or women's rights are indicative of a healthy society. And so that women's rights angle is often another justification used to include women. And the third, I think, is probably the most common, or the idea that women represent half the population. And, you know, their gendered experiences and knowledge and just participation means that you have you understand the community that is being impacted by terrorism and that can fully contribute to countering it. So that kind of half the population approach. But this is a general kind of backdrop to the framework that I developed. And it sounds a little bit complex, but once you get a chance to kind of read through it, it does become something quite transferable in its nature.
And I want to get into some of the examples in the book, but first, one other question from your introduction. You describe how feminist security studies have wrestled with whether to engage in security policy and in some ways have neglected gendered analysis and counterterrorism. How can feminist security studies frameworks and gendered analysis improve our understanding of counterterrorism and possibly even national security outcomes?
Yeah. So I think that in this field, there's been a little bit of a debate, and that debate has kind of wrestled with, do you directly engage with those policies and practices that have often been the kind of focus of critique for feminists who focus on security studies, or do you directly engage with them and try and kind of change it from within or get a better understanding of it by working with these institutions themselves? And so the perspective that I take, or the position that I take, is that it's absolutely imperative to understand these institutions, their actors, their limitations, the aims, culture, all of this. All of those components become relevant to understanding how and why they work the way they do. And in fact, trying to bring a kind of academic research and knowledge to use in a way that's the most effective to them. So I'm very I suppose, activist in my research. I really try and put my research to use in the world around me. And for me, that's meant really trying to move this field towards, or at least in my own way, engaging with these policymakers and practitioners to really try and make this research be put to use in the world in the most effective way possible.
Following 9/11, you provide several examples of how women's rights and oppression became directly linked to how the U.S. measured its efforts to prevent terrorism or improve security. Can you talk about why this happened and how it affected U.S. efforts in places like Afghanistan and Iraq?
Yeah, of course. And I think one of the examples that really jumps out to me the most is it was a statement made by Laura Bush in November of 2001. And she said, quote, "The brutal oppression of women is a central goal of the terrorists. So the fight against terrorism is also a fight for the rights and dignity of women," end quote. And one of the things you really see throughout this entire period is how women's rights become a marker in some ways of success in this fight. And so, for example, what that actually looks like in practice is when you've got a very democracy-centric approach to countering terrorism, you know, there were great efforts by the Bush administration to really implement democracy in places like Afghanistan and then Iraq. But this was seen as kind of a key tool to really kind of push back on the appeal of terrorist organizations. And that meant that as part of this, things like everything from women's political participation, their employment rights, the rights of their and general status in society, the improvement of these became viewed in some ways as markers in the fight against terrorism. But that there's another kind of catch to this as well, because so much of the focus coming out of Washington was really targeted at counterterrorism. A lot of programming that was traditionally kind of outside of the scope of security became increasingly framed in relation to its contribution to countering terrorism. So, for example, in the case of Yemen, there were women's rights program, women's employment programming, and women's education programming that was becoming increasingly justified because of its contribution to countering extremism in that community. And this is where it gets tricky, because it's not necessarily that women's rights or women's empowerment becomes a panacea for countering terrorism. That's incorrect. But in order to actually access that funding from Washington in this period where countering terrorism was the only thing that was really getting that solid funding, there actually became limitations to your funding for important programming like this, unless you kind of framed it in that counterterrorism lens. And so this was something that became quite problematic. You couldn't just have a program that was good for the community that actually did probably inadvertently stabilize the community and lessen the appeal of extremists within it or extremist narratives. But when it starts becoming utilized or almost instrumentalized, this is where it becomes quite problematic.
Well, and I want to ask you to just expand on that further. What are the potential implications of conflating women's rights and counterterrorism efforts?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think some of the concerns could come up with, for example, if a women's rights program or a women's education program start becoming viewed as counterterrorism related or supported by U.S. efforts in places where the U.S. was viewed in a very kind of unfriendly way. And that meant that individuals who are working on this programming could, in fact, be targeted by insurgent groups or be targeted by terrorist groups. Their work could be directly funded based on its perceived contribution to countering terrorism or not. And so if there was a perceived lessening of terrorism concerns coming from that country, then that meant that the funding might dry up as well. And so it became a little bit of a concern in terms of things like how these programs were getting funded and the actual security of persons working on this programming on the ground.
You discuss in detail the administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. What are some of the key differences between how these administrations talked about women and women's roles in counterterrorism?
Yeah, of course. And I think there was such an evolution over this period. And, you know, when you look at, I think a good example to look at are the national security strategies and the national strategies to combat terrorism. So if you look at the two national security strategies under the Bush administration, women are referenced very minimally, and they're referenced in limited terms in relation to things like women's rights, women's education, but also their roles as security practitioners. And under the Bush administration, there really was not a lot of focus on women in this space. But there was a bigger trend that started in the Bush administration and moved through the Obama administration that really focused on countering violent extremism. And so that really kind of more preventative aspect of counterterrorism. And this is something we see come up fully in the Obama administration. And so not only with these preventative efforts do some of the areas where women's participation and women's representation, such as development, really start to kind of gain momentum in this space or gain increased relevance or perceived relevance in this space. But under the Obama administration, we also saw the first National Action Plan on Women, Peace, and Security established in 2011. And this really became a kind of call for the U.S. government to really consider and engage women and think about gender dynamics and all aspects of their foreign policy. And so this is something that really started to, and you know, and particularly in State Department under Secretary Clinton, really start taking momentum forward in relation to how women were being considered and engaged with counterterrorism and particularly CVE initiatives.
I want to talk about some of the agencies that you delve into in the book, and you begin with the Department of Defense and provide several examples of where women came into play in significant ways. And one of these examples is Team Lioness. Can you tell us about this group?
Yeah, of course. There were so many examples of unique programs that were set up throughout this period, very kind of female-centric programs. And so whether it was like Team Lioness, female engagement teams, cultural support teams, a lot of different programs were being stood up, particularly with female service members. And so Team Lioness was one of the first ones set up. And this was formed in Iraq in 2003. And it consisted of groups of female U.S. personnel who offered support services to all male combat units. And this was particularly to assist these units in searching and facilitating interactions with Iraqi women. So it was very taboo and very problematic for male soldiers to engage with local women. And so to create this kind of capability or this operational efficiency, there were these units of women kind of pulled together. And so they started seeing the utility in having women in these kind of roles and started kind of formalizing these units in what eventually became Team Lioness. And so as the kind of training and equipping of foreign forces starts picking up as well over the years, we do see some of these programs being handed over to, for example, Iraqi women. And so a lot of the tasks that Team Lioness initially had were later handed over to local Iraqi women and what became the Daughters of Iraq program. And there were a number of other programs of local Iraqi women that were kind of stood up and supported as well. And this is one thing that I do try and do in the book. So I look at not only programs within U.S. forces themselves, but also in the countries that they trained and equipped and partnered with. So looking at different units that were set up, like an all-female lead counterterrorism unit in Yemen, programs like, again, a Daughters of Iraq program in Iraq, or some of the kind of policing and on defense roles that women were taking up in the Afghan National Army, for example.
With the Team Lioness example, too, I think this particular example provided kind of a good application of the framework because of the multiple angles of how this team operated. And one thing I wanted to ask you about in more detail was related to women's role in combat and how that became clear, the schism between the reality on the ground versus the policy and even training support for some of the women who were engaged in those roles.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you know, a lot of these women's units, women-only units, really highlight a number of kind of concerns in the way that women were engaged in this period. So, for example, you know, women were viewed as providing kind of a softer approach to those communities, or there were kind of there were stereotypes that women would be viewed as kind of a softer entry point or better able to get information from certain individuals. Like some of these programs as well didn't have very clear objectives, some of the support in terms of kind of funding, training, and so forth was not always standardized in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And again, there were a lot of kind of problematic stereotypes about what women's roles were in relation to the kind of fights that they were in and the situations that they were facing. But I think one thing that really became clear over these years in places like Afghanistan and Iraq in particular was, you know, women were inadvertently on the front lines in ways that we just hadn't seen before. You know, these weren't, this warfare was much more embedded. It was much more complicated. And whether you were a medic on the front line, whether you were driving supplies, you know, a lot of these women ended up inadvertently being on the front lines, even though there were these kind of restrictions from them having any kind of combat roles. And that was really, really problematic in terms of the kind of support that they were able to access and the kind of recognition for the work and the risks that they were taking in the space. And we did see women also, you know, fight and die on the front lines as well. But one of the things that really did come out of these two conflicts was, you know, there'd already been a progression about, you know, opening up more roles to women. But in 2015, the announcement was made that all combat roles were going to open up to women. And this was really implemented in 2016. And part of that, well, I think probably a significant component of that was really recognizing all of the work and the sacrifice that women had made and their experiences they'd had, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan and in this global war on terror.
Another theme you discuss, especially in this Department of Defense section, is women as symbolic examples. And there's some very radically different examples in that book, but some of the people that you mentioned, or the stories rather, one is Jessica Lynch, and then also the women who were involved in Abu Ghraib. Can you talk a little bit about some of these symbolic examples that you discuss in the Department of Defense chapters and how those narratives contributed to how women were viewed in this counterterrorism effort?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of the stories of women in this period were generally overlooked, and there were a couple that really kind of stood out and became, I think, symbolic in the public mind in very different ways. And one of them was that of Jessica Lynch. And so in March 2003, she was taken as a prisoner of war by Iraqi forces. And, you know, the media attention around this period and her experience there, I think, really kind of symbolized how women were being framed in this period. So, for example, you know, in the Washington Post in 2004, an official was quoted as saying Lynch had been fighting to the death during a gunfight, receiving significant wounds in the process, or she had fired until she'd had no more ammunition. But it was later demonstrated that, you know, Lynch had not picked up a weapon or engaged in a gunfight. She'd sustained injuries as part of that initial hit. But this rescue operation was a lot more dramatized in public portrayals. And in some testimony that she later provided, you know, this was very, very problematic to her. I think one of the things that really jumped out in this particular example is the idea of kind of rescuing these vulnerable female soldiers. This was how it was being portrayed, I think. She was being fought for, she was being saved, and it really kind of detracted from the idea that she was actually just a regular soldier. And it really kind of made you think a little bit about, if it was a male soldier in the same position, would the reaction in the media have still been the same? Or why focus on the case of Jessica Lynch alone? You know, a lot of her, or another one of her colleagues, Shoshana Johnson, who was an African-American soldier at this time who was injured and became a POW in the same incident, got hardly any media attention at all. So it also raises questions about, you know, who was getting media attention and what kind of framing and to what ends. And so I think she was a really interesting example of kind of the public portrayal of the war to the audience at home. When we get to Abu Ghraib, you know, this became a very, this was a very contentious topic for many, many reasons, and particularly because of the excessive abuse and, in some cases, torture of detainees in U.S. custody. And one of the people that really jumps out in this period the most is Lindy England, who was, that might recall, pictured with detainees in very sexualized and stressful positions. So, for example, there was like a soldier holding a leash placed around the neck of a naked male prisoner, or she was smoking a cigarette and kind of gesturing toward male detainees. And, you know, a number of individuals were eventually convicted in their roles of this kind of detainee abuse. But I think the notoriety of England was quite unique in how it was kind of perceived to be this transgression of a traditional gender norm that she represented. She was kind of objectified. Her agency in these actions was problematically presented. She became viewed as, in this kind of male-dominated and masculinized military sphere. It was being asked, was she doing these activities to try and gain kind of male acceptance from her colleagues? You know, she had a sexual relationship with the ringleader of that abuse, Charles Graner. And it was suggested he kind of used her at this time, and she participated in this abuse to please him. And so, I think the case of Lindy England also becomes interesting for looking at how women who are involved in some of the more problematic aspects that came out of that Iraq war, again, become kind of framed and symbolized in media discourses as well. And I think one thing that I would say is, while I do highlight a couple of these cases like Jessica Lynch or Lindy England, they were very unique examples in many ways too. And there were so many different stories of women throughout this period that I think really deserved attention as well. But they do represent, I think, different ways of how women were being framed in that kind of public, in the public discourses, and particularly towards that audience at home.
Turning to the Department of State, how did the role of women in counterterrorism change and evolve after 9/11?
Yeah, State Department was, as the lead on U.S. foreign policy, the Department of State had such a significant role throughout this period in every country that was being examined. But what was quite interesting, if you look at the Department of State, is how the two kind of key offices that became relevant to looking at women and counterterrorism were often very much siloed from each other. And so if you look at the Bureau of Counterterrorism and then the Office of Global Women's Affairs, they often operated very much outside of each other. But I'll give you an example from the Bureau of Counterterrorism that I think becomes quite interesting for looking at how one component within Department of State was really starting to think a little bit more about how they should be engaging women in relation to counterterrorism. And so around 2007, in some of their community engagement programming, they started trying to think a lot more about how they could better engage with women in local communities, because this had been something up until about 2007 that they'd really overlooked and they saw as a significant shortfall. And so they started setting up a program that eventually became Sisters Against Violent Extremism, which actually still operates today, but that really worked to engage with women in local communities and better kind of support and train them to counter extremism in their own communities. But if we look at, for example, the National Action Plan on Women, Peace, and Security, as well, that was established in 2011, State Department took the biggest steps to really ensure that things like gender dynamics and the roles of women were consistently integrated and reflected in all of their programming under the Obama administration. And you would see this in the kind of yearly implementation plans. They would show very clearly where they had succeeded in really making the roles of women or gender dynamics considered and integrated into their programming, and where they were still falling short. And so I think particularly State Department under Secretary Clinton was one of the departments that really made significant jumps in this period in advancing kind of women, peace, and security objectives in relation to the security practices that they were conducting. And this is something we've really seen roll back a lot under the Trump administration currently.
Speaking of Secretary Clinton, under President Bush and President Obama, we have women leading the Department of State during portions of both of those administrations. What did you observe about their roles as security practitioners?
You know, I think Secretary Clinton is a really interesting example. You know, dating back to the 1995 UN conference in Beijing, you know, Hillary Clinton had really been leading this, the advancement of women, peace, and security concerns globally for many, many decades. And that really came to the fore under her her tenure as Secretary of State at Department of State. And I think, you know, you don't want to say that it had to be a woman that was advancing this work, but she, as an individual, she was a person who had for decades been focusing on this agenda and really made that kind of front and like brought it to the forefront of all of the work being done within within the State Department. And so again, whether it's the National Action Plan on Women, Peace and Security that was implemented under Obama, or whether it was the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review, really trying to systematically ensure that that kind of programming related to women was advanced in ways that just hadn't been seen before. And, you know, I think she really did frame the state, the security of states in relation to the status of women in many, many ways. And I think the work that she did during her tenure was some of the most admirable that was seen out of all of the years that I had looked at. And so, for example, doing things like integrating gender into all strategic planning processes was something that was advocated. And she was willing to really work with other departments and agencies to really try and advance this kind of work. But I think as a woman, too, trying to advance this agenda did receive pushback within State Department in certain corners as well. And it was particularly when there was when the utility or the benefit from advancing this, the status of women in relation to this work or thinking about gender dynamics in relation to this work was not immediately visible. That's where I think it received a bit of pushback. So when that kind of operational benefit was not immediately clear, there just wasn't an appetite by some to really kind of promote this work. And so you do see a little bit of tension over this period as well, even within Department of State.
In your examination of USAID, how does gendered analysis provide additional understanding of this agency's activities and the securitization of foreign assistance?
You know, USAID was, I think, the most interesting agency to look at of the three because, you know, historically, I think USAID's work, the development work, the humanitarian aid work conducted by the U.S. under USAID had really been viewed outside of the sphere of security. You know, you did a development program or an education program because it was the right thing to do. But what we saw after 9/11 was a big evolution in terms of how development became increasingly framed in relation to things like the stabilization of a state, the kind of the preventative efforts that could be utilized to counter violent extremism in a society. And so a lot of the work, the development work that USAID had traditionally conducted became increasingly framed in relation to things like countering violent extremism. And it was interesting because they had the deepest level of gender knowledge and analysis as an organization. And looking back to 1979, there was something called the Percy Amendment that was set up that really drove that gender analysis in all of its programming. So ensuring that development and aid funding and programming did not inadvertently support, you know, men or women. That was ensuring that all programming was done in a way that you do no harm to others in that society. So that gender lens was something that was very visible in USAID. And so as you get into USAID's role in things like countering insurgency, countering violent extremism, and stabilization, you see that gender lens come out a lot more strongly. And so they do tend to think a lot more about, for example, if you're conducting countering violent extremism work, how do you shape a program specifically for men or women? Like, they were a little bit behind the curve on this initially, but you do see them catch up in a way that is much more expansive and detailed than both state and Department of Defense, I would argue. And actually, it was interesting because if you look at things like the counterinsurgency field manual that came out in 2018, the development around that saw USAID sitting at the table with some of the Department of Defense folks. And it was actually that kind of gendered knowledge from USAID that was really informing how that counterinsurgency field manual was evolving. And so whether it was the engagement of women in the field, or how you support women in DDR processes, or even considering things like the diverse roles of female insurgents, or considering things like how women could both be victims and perpetrators of violence in some of these cases as well. Like, I think a lot of the gender knowledge that USAID already had and developed over these years was in some ways and in some contexts kind of trickling into other areas like Department of Defense and how its work was being done.
You end the book with a look at the Trump administration and the future of counterterrorism efforts. And we've seen a very different direction in terms of this administration's national security strategy. Can you talk more about what you've observed in counterterrorism efforts now and in the near future?
Yeah, so I think under the Trump administration, they really have, under the Bush administration and under the Obama administration, there was always this all-of-government approach to counterterrorism, at least articulated. In practice, it was a little bit different, but there was always a defense, diplomatic, and development approach to countering terrorism emphasized. And what we've seen under the Trump administration is a real rollback in not only the funding and support for Department of State, but similar for USAID, and a real kind of uptick in the focus of DOD as a lead actor in countering terrorism. So that's meant that a lot of the preventative work, a lot of the CV work has really been undercut in this period. And a lot of programming related to women in this space has also been kind of whittled down. The one thing that has come up under the Trump administration that is, I would say, admirable, and bearing in mind that this had been developing well before the Trump administration took the office, was the Women, Peace, and Security Act. So one of the big steps that we've now seen is the Women, Peace, and Security Act that was established in 2017. That makes the U.S. the first country in the world to really start thinking a lot more about women, peace, and security in all of its programming throughout the entire U.S. government. And the kind of appetite for taking that up and really integrating it and harnessing it in a way that sees results throughout that whole government, that's a different story. But there has been at least one positive element that has come out of this administration. But otherwise, I think there have been a lot of rollbacks and limitations in relation to not only programming that focuses on women, but really a lot more of the kind of preventative work that is so important to looking at kind of a full spectrum approach to this, to countering terrorism.
Well, Joanna, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we let you go, could you tell us about what you're working on now?
Yeah, so in recent years, there's been a really big focus in some of the work that I've done on women in ISIS in particular. And so alongside all of this work on women in counterterrorism, I've also looked at the evolving roles of women in terrorist organizations themselves. And so some of my current work focuses on the status of women who became affiliated with ISIS in Iraq and Syria and what their current status is today. So looking at things like the rehabilitation and reintegration of women in some cases, looking at the status of those that remain in places like Al-Hol camp in northeast Syria, or those that are in detention in Iraq. So really looking at what happens next to these very significant populations. The second major thing that I'm focusing on right now with my colleague, Devorah Margolin, is a full kind of review of the state of the literature on women and terrorism. There's been research in this field going on for decades now, and I think there's been a real lack of analysis of the state of the field as a whole and what we can really kind of harness from this research of the past and what we can really expand on and clarify in the future. So those are the two kind of areas that I'm really focusing on now.
Well, best of luck. Those sound fascinating. And thank you for being on the show today.
No, thank you so much for having me.
A Woman's Place, U.S. Counterterrorism Since 9/11 by Joanna Cook is available now from Oxford University Press. Thanks for listening to New Books in National Security, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.